Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Eric Gregory Winners event. The Eric Gregory will be set up from a bequest by philanthropist Eric Gregory in 1959, and the first awards were made in 1960, and so next year will be the 60th anniversary. Traditionally, the Eric Gregory Awards are announced in June, and then we hear who they are at the festival, and the winners of that year then come here to read. Unfortunately, this year, the announcement is not to be made until later in July, and someone at the Society of Authors forgot to tell us, which meant that when we were contacting them to find out who was coming this week, no one knew anything about it. So we've quickly made some arrangements to get two of the poets here on Skype. One of the poets has come here from London, hot this morning. And we've also got some winners of the Eric Gregory Award from previous years. The Eric Gregory Award is awarded to about normally half a dozen poets a year. They win several thousand pounds, and they have to be under 30. They submit a collection of up to 30 poems anonymously, which are then judged by a panel of distinguished Eric Gregory judges, this year including Helen Ivory, who is here, to read as a former Eric Gregory winner, one of the poets who has stepped in to the breach. So we'll begin with this year's winners, and I'll introduce them each in turn. The first winner, who you'll see on the screen, is Rabbi Dr. Zohar Atkins, who holds a DPhil in theology from Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar, rabbinic ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary, and an MA and BA from Brown University. He's the author of two forthcoming books, Nineveh from Carcanet next year, and An Ethical and Theological Appropriation of Heidegger's Critique of Modernity from Palgrave Macmillan this year. His poems have appeared in Carcanet's New Poetry 7, PN Review, The Oxonian Review, The Glasgow Review of Books, Black Box Manifold, Wave Composition, Tenebrae, and elsewhere. He's the winner of the 2012 Oxonian Review Poetry Competition and was a keynote poet at the University of York's 2018 Poetics of Faith Conference. He's the founder of Etz Hasader, an educational organization that promotes the creative, existential, and interdisciplinary study of ancient Jewish texts, alongside works of poetry and philosophy. He is a David Hartman Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. So I would like you to welcome Zohar Atkins, who is here on Skype.
Wonderful. So, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much. What an honor. I was just saying before that I can't see you, and so this is an act of faith on my part to share with the abyss through this video portal in the hope that it will touch some hearts. This first poem is called Protest. No sooner do I say, let there be light, than a horde of angels arrives with their signs. No more oppression of darkness. Stop occupying our empty wild. Down with the visible. God should know better than to speak. Even the walls of my hotel lobby seem to sing out against me. But then I remember I'm God. Soon the angels will want to go home. In the end, nobody will remember how they held hands, soaring together like a school into the tear-dusk firmament, how they laid their celestial torsos down in a row to prove my world a desecration. Nobody will hear their words of lament. Holy, 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 as anything but praise. This next poem is a pseudo-autobiographical poem called System Baby. I was six when I first filed for moral bankruptcy. I was 10 when they told me language is inherently classist. At 13, I started defining kindness as making nice to those who like your favorite teams. At 20, I hired a ghost to write my LinkedIn profile. At 30, I started radiosuctive parole therapy. At 41, I began to look sideways and call it inwards. At 86, I'm a work in progress. Today, at 120, I'm a proud piece of gum who's almost forgotten the countless nights it took me, locked in the shoe of the human mind, to get here, to tell you. Don't let others humanize you. Don't let them take away your objectivity, no matter how much they brutalize you. This poem that I'm about to read is called The Sin. The Sin. According to the Zohar, a sin is never as defiant as it seems. Rather, the sin, if it can be so called, always comes from too much of what is proper. The builder's sin, for example, was not that they breached the heavenly palace, but that they stopped at the first gate. Others say the sin was that they made the tower resemble a deity. The builders had placed a sword in the tower's hand, like children drawing on the cover of time. Others say the sin was that they had taken a natural word, Babel, and leveraged it into the brand of a multinational consulting group. This is the true meaning of let us make a name for ourselves. No one agrees, as if the scattering of tongues in the story were a cipher for the interpretive chaos to come. To this day, we continue to debate what bricks to use. Should they be made of rice paper or holograph? Should the tower's shadow be cut through enemy airspace? Can folks in PR really be called builders? I still can't find the word sin anywhere in the story. This poem is called Song of Myself Apocryphal. I am my own listserv, advertising job and fellowship opportunities for myself, by myself, to myself. I sing of unpaid internships to my soul, O soul, and of passing controversies on which to take sides is to take the side of the self. I repost myself and forward myself and respond to myself with emojis. For I am the screen and its anticipation, the pleasure of being liked and of commanding myself to like others. For all pages are contained in my potential for sharing, scrolling, even viewing incognito. I sign in on myself and log out of myself and yet remain more than my usernames and forgotten passwords. For I am the great web itself, and every parody known to it is known to me, and every troll who devastates its comment section is of myself. I am celebrity culture and conspiracy theory culture, the metastasis of meaning that nurtures both political gossip and culture wars, food blogs, parenting blogs, and cat videos. What you shall click, I shall click. And where you shall cut and paste, I shall be cut and paste. Do I make myself redundant? Very well then, I make myself redundant. I am a paywall, disambiguation. I contain metadata. I'll just read two more poems. This one called Nineveh is going to be the title poem of the forthcoming collection. An odd fact is that Jonah wanted to go to Nineveh. It was on his bucket list. He just didn't want to be a prophet. As a student, he'd always dreamed of visiting their fabled bakeries and libraries, of observing the spectacular sacrifices to Baal. In another life, he might even have fled towards Nineveh, stuffed his ears with pitch and bitumen, and renounced the voices in his head. But God had other plans and used Jonah, making him doubly defiant, a renunciate not only of divine commandment, but of his own desire for a secular life, as if it were the punchline to some dialectical joke that can only be appreciated by the depressive realists in heaven. Nothing could have been more pious than boarding the ship to Tarsus. It was by this sign that God knew Jonah was prepared to convert the idolaters at the great city. For the lesson of repentance that he needed is that we must see our avoidance and our drive as leading to the same place. In the unedited version, God shows Jonah that Nineveh was a Potemkin village made only for him. The wicked foreigners were copies of what he found distasteful in himself and his own people. An Israelite can never leave his land, even if he calls it by a different name. We children of Nineveh know this best. No Torah, no 3,000-year history, no prophecy or law can mute the voice of heaven humming in our ears. And with this last poem, I'll conclude. It's called Without Without Title. Without Without Title. A poem that admits there is no meaning besides the gathering of syllables into little bouquets of desire placed somewhere between light and dust is said to need, as winter needs, the beauty of visible breath. If wisdom is not to be had, it is to be sung. A poem is nothing but the sound of emptiness and flesh, or else the sound of a half-naked emptiness caught between an urge to strip, a want to decorate, and a lingering contentment to stay here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zoharis. I hope you hear you had a very appreciative audience here. And thanks for choosing such a great selection of poems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, our next poet, also appearing on Skype, is Victoria Adewuke Bulley. Is a poet, writer, and filmmaker. She's an alumna of Barbican Young Poets. Her poetry has appeared in the Poetry Review, Ambit, and broadcast on Woman's Hour. She was shortlisted for the Brunel University African Poetry Prize 2016, held residencies in the US and Brazil and the V&A Museum. Debut pamphlet, Girl B, was part of the 2017 New Generation African Poets Chapbook Series. She is an alumna of the Complete Works Mentoring Scheme, and her poems appeared in the third 10 anthology from Blood Axe and the Complete Works last year. She's the director of Mother Tongues, an intergenerational poetry, film, and translation project supported by Arts Council England and Autograph ABP. So, Victoria, we can see and hear you. You may not be able to see us, but we will appreciate your reading. Thank you.
Great. Firstly, I'm honoured to be at Ledbury, but also only in wave form or digital form. It's great. So thank you for allowing me to be there with you in this way. My first poem is called About Anna. And if I look like I'm reading off the screen, that's because I am. About Anna. The truth is, nobody knows how Anna Mendieta met her death. It would appear she was pushed. Some distance below, the doorman said he heard a woman shout, "No," and then the sound as her body hit the top of the diner, so hard her face left a mark like a postage stamp. In the photo, she is naked and feathered. She looks like the first woman, like she doesn't know what a camera is, that somewhere in the world it is believed these things can steal a soul. Her arms are out, as if to say, you move them like this to fly, like this, see? Her feet are apart. You can see the sphere of her hips, the delta between her legs. I look at her and think, this is the true work of the body, to adorn itself and be comfortable, unaware, I myself am bored of fig leaves, of shames I did not choose. So the next poem is called What It Means. Essentially what I'm doing right now is reading from the manuscripts that I submitted to the Eric Gregory Award. So I'm just scrolling through. So What It Means. The campus nurse offers up pills like penny sweets. Means it when she says, it's just one less thing to worry about. Her pen is crossing the prescription sheet like a finish line. It's okay. There are many freedoms. In the first world, freedom from bloodshed is tasted between the legs. I don't judge. How would she know I have come to love the cup spilling over the floor of the bath, a Rothko on fiberglass, an opening ceremony, a private showing circa this month? There is nothing like knowing I am an orchestra only rehearsing. This next poem is a was a commission with Tate Exchange on a project that they were running last year, and I was able to respond to any piece of artwork in the new Tate Exchange building, and so I chose to respond to a replica of Marina Abramovich's Zero, what's it called? I've forgotten the name of it. Something Zero. Anyway, Marina Abramovich's famous live performance installation where she laid out a table full of items and invited audiences and visitors to that gallery in Italy to do anything to her using those items. So in this poem, I'm using a list or the list of items that were on the table. And there is a quote that I'm using from The Observer from an interview with Marina, in which she says, a man pressed the gun hard against my temple. I could feel his intent, and I heard the woman telling the men what to do. The worst was the one man who was there always, just breathing. This, for me, was the most frightening thing. After the performance, I have one streak of white hair on my head. I cannot get rid of the feeling of fear for a long time. Zero. Call me what I am. Call me the animal on the altar with the apple of its life in its mouth. Then choose a knife. The kitchen one. Play my neck with its cooking edge. When my skin sings, meet me with your lips. Use the district of the tongue that speaks salt. Taste copper. Think communion. Think loose change, lost baby teeth, lost fights. Count it all joy. Call the taste acquired. Bless the metal in me. What a woman. What a will of iron to bear 6 hours of this, as if for all mankind. Call me Maria, not Marina now. Pour olive oil on my head, call it art. Call me anointed. Give me chains for a necklace. Call the rose a pendant. A petal on each areola, for the hell of it, not for shame. See me and suffer and take a photo. I look good. Say well done. Say I'm wonderful. Say I'm a witch. Take the bullet. Take la pistola and load it. Let it hear me plead from the outside of my skull. Call me mad. Say I asked for it. Ask what I expected. Say I should have known. I should have known what would happen. Put a plaster on my cuts. Say, there, there. Say, I've made it now. Say, you're sorry. Say, Marina. Say, the time is up. Say, the work is done. Say, I'm free to walk. Say, you won't turn and run. Say, you won't turn and run. I'm not sure how we're doing for time, but I'll read about two more. Death is everywhere and not here when the happiest girl I know plays songs by a group called the Deep Throat Choir. And while the others at the bar can't stand it, but don't tell her to her face, I imagine telling strangers my new occupation, brazen and unfazed by the name of my band. These days, everything moves. The white hair I ripped from my scalp at the middle parting turns out to be black at its root, meaning it changed its follicle mind for a whole centimeter or 6 weeks, depending upon who's counting. I, too, want space and time and second chances. I want to be useful and beautiful. But what did I do today except watch a tall building burn? While the boy who once called it home phones the BBC, says, you know at least 500 people live in there. I didn't see 500 people leave, with a voice that implies this is a normal day for him. Death. I think it's you I face when a spider crosses my path in a place I thought was mine. Is it not you who turns overhead with no warning, declaring the night an open disco? There will always be more of you to kill or free. There will not always be mothers with brooms, fathers with cups or glasses. There will not always even be empty glasses. There will not always even be anyone. Only there will be you, death, and the silence and the shade, as the audience traps breath to ask, is this it? Will the music play now? Will the credits roll? Before leaving the cinema, eyes learning daylight again, rebirthing the world, heads brimful in the interim of everything to do and nothing to be done. So while I scroll, welcome to my room. Welcome to my parents' house. It's nice to have you here. Okay, where shall I go next? Okay, let's do this one. Détente. A travesty in two acts. The flesh weakening first, then laughing at itself. Atoms rattling like cans. This much, true. Even before the lie knew and grew heavy, the audience bored and fitful in their seats. True, as in this. You are an idea. I oiled my hands and held them to the flame, then braided my hair. My fingers moved by themselves. Oh, even their shadows stopped to watch. True as in, you are an idea as in, you have occurred to me. And what now is my name? Where went my nation to stitch a future to? All the words to the anthem. Meanwhile, you, with a call that sounds like mine, like a stray true thing as found as stolen rings in the house next door. My fingers moved, they did, which means to admit I turned you over in the night, then put the thought away at dawn. I inhaled and then waited, painted stars on the ceiling at a glance, and noticed how once upon a once, when I caught you soften, it was an interval, And I was made then, whatever strange thing lies in the distance between the hands of God and Adam, outstretched and still yet to touch. So I think that's my time.
Thank you, Victoria. And the audience here were sitting enthralled in their seats to take the line from your poem. So thank you very much for that. And now we're going to move on to the first poet we have in the flesh, who is, if I can find the sheet, it should be Ali. Ali Lewis, born in Nottingham in 1990. Poems appeared in magazines including the Poetry Review, Ambit, the Rialto and Magma. He's got a degree in politics from Cambridge, where he received the John Donne and Precious Pearl Prizes, and an MA in creative writing from Goldsmiths College, where he was shortlisted for the Pat Kavanagh and Ivan Juritz Awards. And he works for the Poetry School, where he runs the Poets Development Projects and edits Campus, the Poetry School's online magazine. Would you please welcome in the flesh, Ali Lewis.
Hi, everyone. Hopefully I won't have any technical difficulties. I'm going to start with a poem called Hotel, which is the title poem of the as-yet unpublished manuscript. It looks at, like quite a lot of my poems do, masculinity, and especially toxic masculinities, and how they interact with relationships. Hotel. She hated the way he repeated himself all along long corridors like a bad hotel carpet, and how, like a bad hotel carpet, he'd wait impatient at the bathroom door so he could start up again as soon as she left. She hated the way he positioned himself to force her to cross him when she wanted to leave, and how, like a bad hotel carpet, he'd always know first about people's affairs and boast how he kept them all quiet. She hated the way he grabbed at the door like a bad hotel carpet whenever she slammed it, and his habit of leading her straight from that door through the hall to the bedroom, as if he couldn't imagine going anywhere else. She hated the way she could easily see him in a Rotary Club or Mason's Grand Lodge, and how, like a bad hotel carpet, he was the same in the bedroom as he was in the bar, as he was in the bedrooms of all of the others. She hated the way he'd wait at the doorstep if she stayed out too late, or roll bright red out into the street, and how, like a bad hotel carpet, his pattern seemed chosen to mask all the dirt, his surface to muffle her steps. This poem is called Making Love to the Knife Thrower, and was inspired by Abigail Parry's poem, The Knife Game, which is a fantastic poem, an amazing collection. Making Love to the Knife Thrower. Of course he had the 60s spinning bed. He told me the trick is there is no trick. Of course he was one for costumes, though this itself may have been a trick. He kissed the sheet next to my neck. He said, the hardest part is keeping still. He licked the bed between my thighs. To put off death, pretend that you have died. He placed an obolus by my every inch, the skills to almost always miss. He promised me that we would never switch. A glamorous assistant has many lives. I'm too scared to kill, and he's afraid to die. That's why we look so different every night. This is a poem called Fractal Date, which I wrote on a residency in Cove Park in Scotland, which I'm very thankful for. Fractal Date. When he snapped at her in the restaurant, she said, that a tree branch looks like a tree, and that a twig also looks like a tree. When he asked if he could speak to the real her, she inquired if he harbored homunculi, little men in his head, and if so, what was in their heads? She said he could substitute the soul or the eye. When he questioned how long she thought it would last, she answered that coastlines get longer the more closely you measure them, that attention to detail is a form of infinity, and that scholars know more and more about less and less. The trick is to catch them somewhere in the middle. When he pressed her to tell him if he was the one and asked if he was, why she would leave him, she replied, there are two notable facts about snowflakes, that they're all so famously different, and that they display what's known as self-symmetry. The edge of a snowflake looks like the edge of a snowflake zoomed in 10 times. She apologized for being obscure. When he asked if this was it, over, she said, you can't tell a stream from a river when you don't know the scale of the map, and that the same goes for arteries and capillaries, of which there were many in her heart, though, of course, many more of the latter. I'm going to read one that's a little bit more positive. This is from a series of poems I'm quoting from, poems and poets who I greatly admire. This poem is called Love Poem to Your Self-Sufficiency, and the opening two lines are from Dana Joya's poem, Becoming a Redwood. Love Poem to Your Self-Sufficiency. Stand in a field long enough and the sounds start up again, as they do when, times I sit quiet in another room and you forget me, eventually, and start to hum. Talk to yourself, cajoling, motivating, praising, and knowing that to call attention to a thing is as often to kill as to save it, I say nothing. Enjoy the sound of you without me, happy. We're doing for time. This is a poem, I'll read two more, I think. This is a poem called Pressure. Pressure. The road clear, the day once in a summer hot, the car so light with just the two of us, shirts slung around our necks, seatbelts off, singing to Rubber Soul on cassette and going 80, 85 downhill when we hit the pheasant so clean and hard it pops. I count feathers disappearing one by one in the rearview mirror, pull into the nearest petrol station, pressure wash blood from the bonnet of my car, from the headlights, from underneath the wheel arches, while you keep watch. Tell me, shaking, I would do this with you. I would do this with you if we'd killed a man. I'll read one more. I just need to pick it. This is a poem called, Is It Our Relationship Even a Thing? Is it our relationship even a thing? Or do we put it in the category of clouds, forests, beaches, etc.? That which is marvelous and foreboding, but which, on closer inspection, doesn't really exist, being individual raindrops, individual trees, grains of sand. And if we do, does that mean that there is no us, or that there is an us, but we only exist in those moments where doing things together, or if not doing things, thinking of each other? And if that is the case, should we not perhaps be kinder to each other and do more things? I only ask because I'm watching this documentary, Saving the Rainforest, and they've spent the whole time tending individual trees. Thank you.
now we move on to some earlier winners of the Eric Gregory Award. And with the time that we have, probably they'll read for 5, at most 6 minutes each, and then we'll have 2 very short ones at the end. So Helen Ivory, originally from Luton, now lives in Norwich, won an Eric Gregory Award in 1999, and she's now judging the Eric Gregory Award. She then disappeared into a field in the Norfolk countryside to look after 2,000 free-range hens. She emerged 10 years later, having published 2 collections with Blood Axe Books, and had helped with Owen Bare Hands to build several houses. Her latest collection from Blood Axe is Waiting for Bluebeard, 2013, and her 5th collection, The Anatomical Venus, is published in April of next year.
Thank you, and thank you, Neil. Okay, I'm just going to read you a handful of poems from Waiting for Bluebeard, which is a book. It's in 2 parts. The first part is poems based on my childhood. The second part, me living in an abusive relationship with a person who I call Bluebeard. So this is from the first part of the book, a typical night in my parents' house. Basically, my parents shouldn't have been married. Okay. The family at night. We were ragdolls after school and passed the long winter evenings like this. Father in his armchair with an unlit pipe, mother in the kitchen pretending to eat, my sister and I with our small occupations. We saw little with our button eyes and spoke even less with our stitched-up mouths. We played at playing till it was time for bed, when mother sewed our eyelids down so we could get a good night's rest. We always woke as our human selves to find the downstairs rooms had altered too. A chair unstuffed, a table's legs all wrong, and that one time kittens gone from their basket, the mother's bone hollow meow. I'm on a creaky floorboard. Add my own percussion, which is completely inappropriate to the poems. Anyway, sorry, I've kind of... Yeah. So this is the poem that is a kind of a hinge poem. It's a kind of out of the frying pan into the fire poem, and it's a sequence. And it's based on a little sculpture by Alice Meyer called The House of Thorns. The House of Thorns. It takes no more than a word for a flame to stir in its womb, for smoke to rise and push at the walls like a trapped and injured beast. There is no chimney, no window, no gasp of air. So the fire that's grown too big for the hearth will die before it eats up the room. Here is a bed for the wolf. Here is a chair burst at the seams. And here's the little pot that will cook and cook and cook. It's hard to imagine a path from this house when you can't imagine a door. The roof is braced against all 4 winds. You're swaddled inside a coat of thorns. There are stories about spring mornings, about dew-soaked grass, the signature of your footsteps, you, the only child on earth. The house is blind to romance, makes you pin down your tongue, rocks you till you fall asleep, hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye. When the seeds are planted and the roses are grown mature enough for a harvest of thorns, and all of the effort of building a home tattoos neat scratches on your parents' hands. Now think of a house. Think of another house. A house of your own, cut from the cloth of your very own skin. The thought rises up like a singing clock, its bird constructed of feathers and springs. Through this part of the book, there's a little sequence called The Disappearing, because when you're in an abusive relationship, or I don't know, any situation where you kind of find yourself disappearing out of yourself and becoming, I don't know, other. So this is the first in the sequence, The Disappearing. The tariff for crossing the threshold was a single layer of skin. She imagined a snake unzipping itself in one deft move. She imagined herself live inside the house, her new home. She didn't imagine scarring nor the painstaking care required to leave the ghost of herself on the doorstep like a cold caller. I'll introduce you to Bluebeard a little bit, I think. He's in this one. I'm going to read three more. I'm assuming I'm in time. I cannot see the clock. It is a blur since I've taken...
Two more.
Okay, okay, I'm really, 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 really fast. Okay, Rabbit Season. Woken by the sharp burn of moonlight on her face, she moves to the window, sees searchlights unearthing the season's rabbits, then remembers the child. The last time she'd gone out, she lost her slippers in the river, so now her bare feet carry her. Down the stairs, along the hallway, over the patio and into a night cut with gunshot. She digs at the edge of the lawn with a spade first, then with her hands to be closer to her work. By dawn, there are little mounds of earth, but still no child. She tidies herself up in time to make Bluebeard's porridge. She watches him emerge from the fields, his mossy boots soaked with dew, a string of rabbit pelts at his waist, all their open eyes. This is a further of the disappearing. This is number 7. She already knew her bones were there for all the world to see, so she unpeeled her hide in the changing rooms. Bluebeard barely recognised her small, neat form, slicing through the footbath like a fox through night. In the pool, she was an electric storm, and the water shrunk away. She marvelled, oh, the joy! She couldn't feel a thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next poet gives you a second chance to see Dom Berry, who read here yesterday as one of the winners of this year's National Poetry Competition. He's also won first prize in the Magma Poetry Competition and second in the Resurgence Poetry Prize. He lives in Devon, where he runs workshops on nature, eco-poetry and the emotional impact of climate change. And he won an Eric Gregory Award in 2016.
Good afternoon. It's really, really lovely to be reading alongside this year's winners. I know how much it meant to me. When I got the envelope through the door, it was just a really special moment and a recognition of the work that you maybe have put in the past, and it felt a very important moment. So massive congratulations this year. I read three poems for you. Pug. Yes, a bow, a pink bow, and yes, a silk dress, force another dress on it, mother, the polka dot one, the one with lace, then snap up its chains and make it jig. She, my mother, swags weak old wolves for altering. Yes, love is a hot sack of pups for stripping the mutt from. She, my mother, brings weak old wolves for altering, for me to snip the wee coarse tails from. All night my mother cuts these small mutts down to hoof, to knees. All night her heart, a cattle prod ticking. Then by hoof, by gum, I stitch them up again. Each trial, each toy gone wrong. Each one with a bullfrog in its throat and its pig's face on. But know, mother, how each pug plugs only one small hole in me. That there is an entire doll's house in my chest that still needs filling. My friend, the physicist, attempts to explain his version of E equals MC squared. Like any good atheist, my friend, let's call him Maximilian, is disproportionately petrified by events of biblical proportion. Even so, his notebook, or rather his little love letter to all equations, is filled not as you might imagine, but with stained photographs. Here is 1945, here is 1986, 2001, and here 2027. Max shows me Hiroshima, Chernobyl, two eyes sunk into Manhattan, a meadow from my own childhood, still sprung of forget-me-nots, still then. And here is the mass of my whole consciousness. Max strips back a light white sheet to show a calf cut up, relaxing on the stripped back metal countertop. His last experiment. Besides the small, imprecise marks of his teeth, I notice most the open jaw. Yes, a pink butt plug, and in its gut a gastric band thrice looped. And to think, Max shouts, we can place a man on the moon, but a whole race undone by farting. Max flips up his black chalk chart, begins scribbling. Methane, that's him. Plus carbon, that's you, Sonny, equals et voila. Instead of an equation, I see London, Rio, Jakarta, LA, lights off, clocks stopped, foxes pouring through darkness, my father raped, the daughter I am yet to sire, succumbing to torture, water forced drop by drop into her skull to induce madness. Fuck Einstein. I look back at Max. Max stares back. You see, it really is as simple as that, as this. Watch. A breath. A movement. A moth throbbing the air open. Then Max's two hams clatting, clapping it shut. Then silence. Max opens his hands, opens the moth's slack wings, and whispers, action, reaction. All I can offer you is this, how one evening each autumn, a little after dark, the swallows return home, how you can hear then in the roof their wings clicking close, their hive mind shutting down each map that followed without intention, another map to these eaves, this house, I come alive here, then I heal. But this autumn the swallows have not come home. The kitchen is silent, but for the click of the clock and the whir of the drum, and the hum of the stove, and the drone of the telephone, and the world is now lighter, yet somehow, somehow also more heavy. Thank you.
Thank you, Dom, and thank you for hanging on, because he's about to walk to the South Coast. And next we will have Kim Moore, just speeding things up. Her first collection, The Art of Falling, published by Seren in 2015. She won the Eric Gregory Award in 2011 and the Jeffrey Dermer Prize in 2010. And she's going to read for 5 minutes, and then we've got to squeeze two more in. So, Kim Moore.
Thanks. It's really exciting to hear the new Eric Gregory people. It's fantastic, and the old ones as well, of course. And I also think all poetry reading should have a picture of the poet's bedroom behind. It was so exciting to see everyone's houses. So I'm just going to read two poems. And in the spirit of the Eric Gregory people reading from their new kind of unpublished manuscripts, I'm going to read for two new ones as well. We are coming under cover of darkness with our strawberry marks, our familiars, our third nipples, our ill-mannered bodies, our childhoods spent hobbled like horses, where we were told to keep our legs closed, where we sat in the light of a window and posed and waited for the masters of the world to tell us again this is how a woman is made. We are arriving from the narrow places, from the spaces we were given, with our curses and our spells and our solitude, with our potions we swallow to shrink as small as insects or stretch us into giants, for there will be giants among us, we must warn you. And riots, we're carrying all that we know about silence. We are returning from forests and towers, unmaking ourselves, stepping from the pages of books. We are coming from the cages we stayed in, where we spent our wages, from the beds we were fucked and afraid in. We stand at the base of our own spines and watch the bone turn to tree and climb each vertebrae to crawl back into our minds. We've been out of our minds all this time, our bodies saying yes, we were born for this, dragging the snare and the wire behind us, returning from madness where we lived for years. Move out of the way, we are coming, we are entering here. And I'm working on a sequence called All the Men I Never Married, which I got a bit carried away with. I'm now on number 35. And it's a mix of kind of ex-boyfriends and then random men, not in that way that I've just made it sound. And this is one of the kind of not an ex-boyfriend, it's a boy, actually. It's and the sequence kind of explores sexism and then female desire and the kind of the idea that often if we talk about female desire, it invites sexism into the room anyway, so they kind of sit next to each other. But this is All the Men I Never Married, number 7. When he tells me I'm not allowed to play with cars because I'm a girl, I bring his arm up to my mouth and bite. I'm sent to the Wendy house to pretend to be good. Blank-faced dolls stare up at me. Pretend oven filled with plastic fish fingers. Pretend windows with flowery curtains sewn by someone else's mother. Pretend Hoover. Pretend washing machine. Pretend teapots and tea set. I watch through a gap in the wall as my teacher sits in her chair, crossing her legs in the way she told us only yesterday we should copy. Be ladylike, she said. Stop showing your knickers. I'm burning in here as she calls the class to order, waits for them to cross their legs and settle. I long to sit at her feet, listen to all the old stories with sleeping and women who wait to be rescued. The book is a bird, its wings held tight in her hands. She bends the cover back so the spine cracks, balances it on one palm, turns to me and tells me, turn around at once, face the wall. Thank you.
Our penultimate poet won an Eric Gregory Award in 1982. He founded the poetry press Blood Axe Books in 1978, and he's published 2 poetry collections, 2 novels, and many anthologies. And he's just going to read 2 poems. First one is called Black and Blues, which is a blues spoken by death in the voice of a corpse. Black and Blues. A body bag unzipped itself and slipped an oh-good body loose. It toasted its own blackened health, fired off a tirade of abuse. Death cries, its blackened body blues. Let cockerels crow the firestorm glow when missiles cruise your streets at night. Let heads and tails spin round rounds a red and yellow tracer light. Death dances to the blackened blues. When gunships home in on your homes, a crowded shelter's your best bet. Its infrared is easy meat for a heat-seeking exocet. Death cries, your blackened body blues. The curfew wakes at crack of dawn when guns are chattering like cold teeth. Let bullets sing out in the trees. The convoy sighs without relief. Death dances to the blackened blues. Nowhere to run on a death march when mortars pound the town ahead. Children are slow, they're first to go when snipers earn a pound a head. Death cries, their blackened body blues. My fighters are all irregulars. Their Semtex breaths like marzipan. The safe areas are never safe except to death's militia man. Death dances to the blackened blues. The clampdown brings on a seizure. The ceasefire holds in its breath. The bread queues panned with hot cross fire. The unmarked van delivers death. Death cries those blackened body blues. And secondly, a related poem, For Want of a Nail. Their leaders bought blind because of the cost. Their MiG-15s, ex-Afghan, wouldn't fly. The ground troops halted, the battle was lost. The breakaway republic doomed to die. For want of support, for want of a nail. The warring factions kept up their attacks on the besieged enclave. Their envoys' news didn't reach them. Something wrong with the facts from the Geneva talks. Their Christmas truce shot down. The town fell for want of a nail. The radio went off the air. The rebels stormed the presidential palace, but the federal forces basted them, in Goebbels' phrase, because they needed guns, not butter, for greasing the wheels, for want of a nail. The surgeon needed sleep. The drip feed seal was faulty. Someone left a swab inside. The new heart failed. The rupture wouldn't heal. They kept him on dialysis. He died for want of a bed, for want of a nail. The cargo shifted. The bow doors weren't closed. The lorry hit a car and shed its load. She'd be here if the council hadn't closed the school. She had to cross the busy road, victim of the cuts, for want of a nail. The walkway fell 50 feet from the deck. Rescuers were late. The ambulance stalled. The owners said there'd been a safety check last year. It wasn't the company's fault that corners were cut, for want of a nail. Warnings not heeded, for want of a nail. Nor safeguards observed, for want of a nail. Usual precautions, for want of a nail. Normal procedures, for want of a nail. No proper funding, for want of a nail. The phone line broke. The deadline expired. They stormed the plane. The hostages were shot. The talks broke down. The army marksmen fired. They couldn't reach the trapped people. And not for want of trying, for want of a nail. Disaster waited for want of a nail. The president killed for want of a nail. His aides couldn't help for want of a nail. The government fell for want of a nail. A spokesman claimed for want of a nail. Thank you for that. And finally, my fellow 1982 winner, Alison Brackenbury. I'll just let you read because there's no time for an introduction.
Cheers. Hi, delighted to be here. Can you hear me at the back? Great. As part of this excellent reading, to end this excellent reading, I will read one poem from my new book, my 10th book, Aunt Margaret's Pudding. This is based on the handwritten recipes of my grandmother, Dorothy Eliza Barnes. When I knew her, she was a shepherd's wife, but as a young woman, she had been an Edwardian professional cook. This is a poem which I hope is suitable for this season and this region. It's called Summer Fruit. You whisked meringues, light pancakes, lest Madam woke bored. You did not write two recipes I loved the best, that dark blancmange named chocolate mould, which, young paid cook, you once coaxed whole from fluted copper's fragrant gold, then spooned for us from your gilt dish. African nights caressed slow tongues. We tasted empires, bitter, rich. How could you find fruit in that flat and flowered land? Air bloomed, you caught the Barton bus in your best hat. Plum jam set August, amber simmered to slow taste, whole, spooned on warm sponge, as boots came off. Orion glimmered. Summer, you said, for that great war was like none after or before, the loveliest you ever saw. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll ask for a round of applause for the past and present poets. I won't name them all. You've heard them all. Also, before I do that, can I please recommend the exhibition Talking Transformations, Home on the Move, which is upstairs gallery at Enchant on Allure. If you've not seen it, do come and check it out. I also need to thank, as I didn't at the beginning, Arts Council England for sponsoring the festival and this event, and also Society of Authors, of course, for sponsoring this event. So would you please thank all our wonderful winners in the flesh and from the ether. Thank you.